Into the Weird, Episode 11, The Wicked and the Weird, our top 5 Bronze Age oddball villains.
Welcome to Into the Weird, a podcast focusing on the Marvel Bronze Age of everything weird and strange. I'm your host, Doc Strange, and with me as always is my co-host, Herman Lowe. How are you, Herman?
Great, Billy. I feel really good today because we're going to be talking about some wacky stuff. And that's why I got into Marvel Bronze Age. I don't know about you. It's for all this weirdness, for all this silliness, and comics should be weird, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I love superheroes from the Bronze Age, but what really is my favorite is everything that's weird and strange about the decade, for
yeah,
sure.
That's right. And I'm sure you would agree, Billy, that nothing got weirder than the villains that were introduced in the Bronze Age. I mean, there were some wacky characters that came. I mean, you think about superheroes being weird at that time, Howard the Duck and people like that. They were already strange. But then you got these guys that, you know, they touted as the villains. Wow. Mm-hmm. Things got ridiculously silly. And listeners, that's going to be our topic this week. We're going to present you with a bit of a bonus episode, which is still going to count as a regular episode. I think this will be Into the Weird episode 11. But, you know, we're going to be talking about not something issue related. Rather, we're going to be looking at our favorite, wackiest, weirdest, strangest villains. And Billy, you've got your list prepared. I've got my list prepared. We talked about the list beforehand, but I was surprised that our lists didn't really have an overlap because there's just so many weird characters to choose from. What do you think, Billy? When you send me your list on Twitter, I was like, hey, these guys are incredibly weird, but I don't have any of them on my list.
Yeah, I mean, when I sent you my list, I expected the exact same thing. I'm like, oh, there's definitely going to be at least two or three with some overlap, but there wasn't, which is good because, you know, it'll give us a little bit more to talk about. But yeah, top 5, you know, weirdest villains, and away we go.
That's right. That's right. Billy, you're going to start us off. We're going to start from number 5. You're going to give your villain, then I'm going to discuss that with you, and then I'm going to give my number 5, and then we're going to do that until we get to number 1. And then we'll do some honorable mentions at the end before we commence with our regular show segments. But listeners, please be aware we're not going to be discussing an issue of Doctor Strange or Morbius or Man-Thing or Ghost Rider this time around. So this is our main segment, the top 5 wackiest, weirdest villains, our personal favorites. Billy, what's your number 5?
Okay, so my number 5 is Elf with a Gun. so, woo! Yeah, you can't go on and have a list of anything weird or bizarre without a Steve Gerber creation. Steve Gerber and Sal Buscema, Defenders number 25, 1975. You can't. This guy's got to be on at least a top 10 list. I mean, how can it not be?
Well, I mean, yeah, this is one of the surprises. I didn't have him on my list. He's clearly a villain. You know, obviously, because of what he does. He shows up randomly, pops people by shooting them with a gun, and then he disappears. And I don't think the storyline was ever resolved, was it, Billy?
You know, when Steve Gerber, you know, quit, got fired there at the end of the 70s or early 80s with Marvel when he was having his dispute over Howard the Duck. I know there was an issue in the Defenders, maybe in the high 40s, early 50s, where David Anthony Kraft had taken over.
That's right.
And he wrote, you know, somewhat of a demise for the elf with a gun. But it was a strange character. Like, it's one of those characters that you, when you read that character or a lot of characters by people like Steve Gerber, if you're younger, you probably just don't get it. Like, when I read the Defenders, it was more of a superhero comic to me, because a lot of it didn't sink in. But then when I got a little bit older and, you know, you start realizing, like, this is not a superhero comic like, you know, the Avengers or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's very strange, bizarre. There's a lot of, you know, meta.
Yeah.
Steve Gerber was just, he was wild. He's one of my favorite writers of all time. And just when I was looking into not only just about this character, but what he had to say about this character, there was an interview where he said, it was a nonsensical character created as a metaphor for the chaotic and inexplicable nature of existence.
Whoa.
The thing you spend a lifetime planning for, but still comes as a surprise or never at all.
Oh, my
so
God. That's
right
deep.
There what he was thinking when he created that character. Because the first time I read it, I was like, oh, wow, well, this is crazy. This is going to end up being something huge. And it never did. It just, he, like you said, he just randomly show up and kill someone that had nothing to do sometimes even with the story. They were just passerbys, and like three or four issues would go by and he'd do it again and he'd do it again. And
yeah.
I'm thinking to myself, okay, something's building huge here, and it never did. And
yeah,
when you look into it and read what Gerber had to say about it, that's, it never was supposed to be anything big.
Yeah, it was just something as an aside that he wanted to put in to express his personal nature of the universe, really, his personal view of the universe. Which mm-hmm. was that things are chaotic. And like you say, random elements, you know, cause things to happen that throw your plans, you know, into the grinder. So basically, a good metaphor, but since it wasn't resolved by Gerber himself, I always thought it fell flat. I did read the issue by Kraft, where it was sort of quote-unquote resolved. But, you know, at that point in time, I was so disappointed with it, because I was expecting something big, just like you, Billy. But, you know, the thing is, when I was reading The Defenders way back when, in the late 70s, I didn't have a complete run of the early comics. So I thought this was part of something that had happened before, an old villain that was cropping up, someone who's getting revenge, someone maybe who's time traveling or taking out people who would be important to The Defenders. I wasn't sure about what was going on. It was only much, much later, I think in the early aughts, when I picked up The Defenders Masterworks, mm-hmm. where I got the complete stories, and it wasn't even a complete story. So I was very disappointed in how it shaked out. But a brilliant inclusion to this list, Billy, because talk about strange. An elf with a mm-hmm. gun. Even the idea is so completely wacky. You know, why give an elf a gun?
Yeah, it makes no sense, but for Steve Gerber, it makes perfect sense. So
that's right,
you know,
that's right.
That's number five. So what's your number five?
Okay, my number five is a little bit, I'm cheating a little bit here. It's a character that you might know about, Diamond Head. Now, why am I cheating with this character? Because there are actually two versions of this character in the Marvel Bronze Age. My favorite version at first was the Nova villain. He first showed mm-hmm. up as a Nova villain, and his name was Archibald Diker. I think he showed up in mm-hmm. Nova. Yeah, he showed up pretty early on. I think it was Nova number 3, mm-hmm. around 1977. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1976. And he was created by Marv Wolfman and Sal Buscema, who were, you know, the creative team on Nova at the time. And basically, he was just a bodybuilder, I think. He started out as a bodybuilder, and then he became, because he was, you know, he had criminal inclinations, he became a professional thief, and somehow he was mutated by a diamond-powered laser while he was stealing diamonds at the time. And then he developed, well, this mutation gave him a super strong diamond-hard body. And that's how he became a criminal. Now that doesn't sound all that wacky, but his appearance is what really struck with me all these years as totally strange. Yeah, he's got the super strong diamond-like form, but then he's also got a head in the shape of a diamond. Mm-hmm. So picture the Spider-Man villain Hammerhead, you know, and then think about that kind of dome-like head that, or that kind of flat-topped head that you find in the Dick Tracy villain, flat top. And then also couple that with some Kirby kind of imagery in your mind of him drawing J. Jonah Jameson with this flat top of hair at the top. So he's like an amalgamation of those four characters. And his head is just the strangest thing ever. It's literally the shape of a diamond. Mm-hmm. And okay, he's pretty powerful. It's just the character's very, very wacky. And later on, he joins the, I think they're called the Terrible Trio, you know, with Condor and Powerhouse, some of Nova's, you know, first foes that he fought in issue 2. Mm-hmm. And they become, you know, Nova's main team of bad guys that combat Nova. But, you know, why am I saying that there's another iteration? If you go way back, Billy, to 1970, there is the wackiest version of Diamond Head yet. And he's a Captain America villain who started off as a black gangster, an African-American gangster called Rocky the Lynx. And then he decided, okay, you know, he's been beaten by Cap. He was part of the Magia. He would assume another identity of a supervillain called Diamond Head. So literally he looked like a pimp, like a black, you know, 1970s blaxploitation pimp. With this fur coat, and then he had this diamond-shaped mask straight out of a horror movie. I mean, think about if Jigsaw from the Saw franchise had like a diamond mask instead of just that plastic thing he wears. That's kind of what this guy looked like. And
wow.
You know, basically, he did what the Black Panther Society did. He preached hatred against the white man, and but the Falcon opposed his rhetoric, and then eventually he was defeated. But again, as with the Diamond Head character from Nova, this guy just had a wacky appearance, but he also had some mm-hmm. some pretty strange, you know, ideals and morals, and that's why I picked him, you know, coupled with the Diamond Head from Nova as my number five. So it's kind of like cheating, Billy. I apologize. It's two characters in one. But
well,
you know,
that's okay. I mean, yeah, I knew the Nova villain because I have maybe about 8 or 10 issues of Nova scattershot issues, and I have one that has him in it, and the visual, like you said, is very, very bizarre. Nova, if you look at that series, Nova is really weird. There are a lot of very, very strange villains in there. I mean, like you said, Diamond Head, and then I know for sure there's at least 2 issues where the Tomb of Dracula villain, Dr. Sun, is in that series.
That's right. And yeah, he's in there for some strange reason. Yeah, Dr. Sun's going to be one of my honorable mentions because, I mean, come on, a brain in a jar, that's weird, but I love it. But yeah, he was, he definitely had some dealings with Dr. Sun. I think, you know, it was at the time when he allied himself with the Sphinx. And the Sphinx and Dr. Sun, they were even working mm-hmm. together at that point in time. Wasn't that what was happening,
yep.
Billy?
Yep. And then somehow Dr. Sun ended up having like almost a robotic body, and then the head was in the jar still on top of
the head's got to be in the jar, otherwise he's not Dr. Sun anymore. Oh, brilliant. So I hope that my number five is worthy of inclusion in this list of weirdness, Billy. So yeah, that's my number five.
For sure.
Something I forgot to mention, the very first iteration of Diamond Head, which was actually the Captain America villain who was part of this Black Panther-like society. His first appearance was in Captain America number 126 from June 1970. And he was created by Gene Colan, your favorite artist, Billy. Gene mm-hmm. the Dean. And also Stan Lee. So yeah, the two of them created that first Diamond Head. So listeners, go find those issues, check them out, they're suitably wacky. So Billy, what about your number four?
Okay, so my number four, this is, you know, digging deep. Anybody that's a huge Werewolf by Night fan will know this guy. His name is Dr. Glitter Knight. And this guy, I mean, he literally looks like the Watcher in this really funky robe, black and gold robe. And he's an extra-dimensional being that can steal souls, create, you know, conjure up demons and zombies. And then something I didn't even know, but I found out when I was researching him, he can control certain breeds of dogs, it said.
What? That's one of his powers? Oh, man. He definitely has to make this list. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it was crazy. I thought, what does that have to do with anything?
Yeah, I mean, I remember this guy from... Okay, now this is a bit of blasphemy on my part. Billy, you know I'm a big horror fan. I mean, I've even got the podcast, The Long Box of Darkness. But Werewolf by Night is the only Marvel horror property that I've only read once. And the first time I... Well, the first and only time I read through the series was because I got this omnibus, which they put out a couple of years ago from a friend for a birthday present. And then, you know, I did what I normally don't do. I sort of read the entire thing in the span of a week without taking kind of breaks between issues and story arcs. Now, what happens to me, I don't know if you're the same, is when I do that, especially since I'm above the age of 40 now, I don't remember what I've read a couple of weeks afterwards. So
I'm the same way.
Oh, are you the same? Oh, man, that makes me feel a bit better. Because I hate admitting weakness. But yeah, that's definitely my kryptonite. In my old age, I kind of have to read comics multiple times to let the stories really, you know, seep in. And unfortunately, with Werewolf by Night, my single read through of Werewolf by Night, you know, it didn't really give me all that I wanted out of the series. I better go back and reread it at some point in time. But I remember this guy. When the first time I read him, he kind of reminded me of a controller who's kind of the DC, it's a DC type villain. The controllers, they show up in Legion of Superheroes, and he's got, like, you know, this the look of a controller. And I know he's magical based, not really you know, scientific based. I mean, the guy's a necromancer, for God's sake, but I can't remember the storyline. So now I want to find out more about this dog controlling talent of his.
Yeah, I read that and I thought, what is this? Because I've only read his Bronze Age appearances, but I think he actually has an appearance in the, I don't know which volume it is, but the 1988, that series of Doctor Strange that started that year.
Oh, okay. The Sorcerer Supreme series?
Yes. Okay. He's in there somewhere too. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that had to be the whole, like, controlling dogs thing, because I don't recall any of that going on in Werewolf by Night. Those Werewolf by Night stories are really crazy. Like, the artwork and everything is just, it's out there. Werewolf by Night, that's a really weird series. Like, it started out being just straight up horror for probably, I don't know, the first 12 or 15 issues. And then there was a little period in there where it was still horror, but it was kind of in a transitional period. But then when the creators that created Dr. Glitter Knight took over, Doug mentioned Don Perlin, it started to get more into being like almost like a superhero book with, you know, a horror character as the main character.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah. I remember that was the time that, you know, Moon Knight also showed up. I think the first appearance of Moon Knight was in Werewolf by Night, if I'm not mistaken. Then Doug Munch created that, and then, or he brought that in. And then, you know, you had lots of cameos from other Marvel superhero characters just to up the sales of Werewolf by Night. I remember that. But, you know, back in the day, Billy, I wasn't reading a lot of Werewolf by Night because for some reason I couldn't find them on the spinner racks as often as I could find the other titles that I was reading at the time. So, you know, I had some scattershot issues here and there. But like I say, when I did the read through, I noticed that trend in the later issues, starting around issue 27 or so, you know, when things started to change and become more of a supernatural comic instead of just straightforward horror. So still Dr. Glitter Knight, man, a worthy inclusion indeed. Just the name itself, you know. I quickly looked him up here on Comic Vine and I see he's got an alias, Heka Nut. Woo! And some what they also say here, he's a god or a god slash eternal. So, you know, I'm definitely going to research this guy and try to read him again in the pages of Werewolf by Night, because he sounds ridiculously interesting.
Yeah, he is. It's insane. And the visual, like I said, he's just, it's big, like, dopey looking bald white dude. He looks like the Watcher. He really literally does look like the Watcher, just not like 50 feet tall, but he looks like a miniaturized Watcher.
Yeah, he does. He with a massive dome-like head.
Yeah, he's an absolute goof. But yeah, Werewolf by Night number 27, 1975. There's his first appearance.
Awesome.
All right, on to number four. What do you have, Herman?
Okay, Billy, my number four is also a Defenders villain. I mean, if you think about it, the Defenders and Doctor Strange and, you know, those issues, that those teams, they had lots of weird villains. And this guy's one of the weirdest. Mm-hmm. It's a sorcerer by the name of Kalazuma. Now, if any of you listeners are familiar with the very early issues of the Defenders, Kalazuma, his first appearance was actually in Defenders issue number 2 from October 1972. And he turned up in the Alps, but we'll get to that. Basically, he was a powerful sorcerer, and it took basically the entire roster of the Defenders at that time, Namor, Hulk, Doctor Strange, and the Silver Surfer to take him out. But the way that they encountered him is ridiculously strange. Basically, he and his acolytes, who were all sorcerers themselves, they were part of a gang called the Warrior Wizards. And they, for some reason, had all sequestered themselves in the Himalayas. The Himalayas. I mentioned earlier the Alps. It was the Himalayas. And they had transformed themselves into these ape-like creatures. For some reason, they looked like Yetis. That's probably where the Yeti legend stemmed from.
Maybe they started interbreeding with the Yetis.
It could be. Who knows? I mean, they were there in the Himalayas, removed from society, living this peaceful existence of Yetis, you know, Yeti-like existence. And then the Silver Surfer happened upon them. And because he was so disillusioned and disappointed with humanity, he decided, I'm going to, you know, kind of like the Kree did with the Inhumans and the Celestials did with the Eternals, I'm going to start my own race of men. I'm going to train these guys up to be good, morally well-adjusted beings, and I'm going to teach them. So the Silver Surfer, he became their teacher. Eventually, the Defenders tracked the Silver Surfer down. And then, just, you know, they were fighting these ape men for a while because, you know, the Hulk was there and he sees these giant hulking things. He's going to think, okay, it's time for a scrap. And then Silver Surfer said, no, wait a minute. These are peaceful creatures. I'm training them. And then suddenly, all of the Yetis transformed into the Warrior Wizards with Kalazuma at their head and says, ha ha, we fooled you. We were actually Kalazuma and the Warrior Wizards all along. And then, you know, they started to attack. And this was all part of a scheme of the wizard Necrodamus as well. He wanted to steal Namor's body, but that's getting very convoluted. Basically, they then attacked Doctor Strange and the Defenders and had to be defeated by them. But what a wacky storyline, Billy. I mean, these Himalayan Yetis just suddenly transforming into this bunch of wizards.
You know what? There have been, I don't know if you've been reading the news, but there's been a lot of accidents and some deaths up there lately. People, I don't know if there's just people that are climbing up there that don't know what they're doing. They're inexperienced or something like that. But,
yeah,
you know, not to be mean about it, but maybe there's something going on up there.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Apparently Kalazuma's up there.
Yeah, Kalazuma and his Yetis, they must have encountered these climbers. But yeah, Billy, this has been the deadliest year ever for Everest, right? And for the...
It's weird.
Yeah, strange. Yeah. I don't know. I should research that more. But yeah, it's funny you mention it because... but it didn't matter to the Defenders. I mean, Namor, at one point in time, he needs some water, so he quickly rubs some ice on his body. He makes a snow angel and powers up again. Oh, man, I love those early Defenders issues. So, and then another thing is, Billy, I don't know, can you recall the look of this guy, Kalazuma?
Oh, yeah, he almost looks like a Satan-type figure. Like, doesn't he have, like, a red cowl and stuff like that?
Yeah, he's got, at first, he does have a bit of a cowl. He's got like little Satan horns on his head. He's wearing this this red skull cap and these red gloves, but he's also got a lot of blue, you know, so you've got some primary colors in there. And then he's got that great Sal Buscema face, you know, where it looks like his jowls are hanging down and drooping, and he's got this massive mouth. And, you know, he obviously a match for Doctor Strange and the Defenders. So powerful, but crazy and strange. So definitely my number four. But Billy, tell me, what about your number? Now we're on number three. Yeah, I guess we're flying through these things. So what do you have as your third wackiest villain?
Well, for number three, I have to go back to dip back into the Steve Gerber well and go with Mandrill.
Yes.
He is insane. I mean, the first time I encountered him was in the Defenders. He is an insane. I mean, I read up. He's a mutant. I wasn't always sure how he got to be. You know, it's like a guy. His name's Jerome Beachman or Beecham or something like that.
Yeah, Jerome Beachman. That's his name. Guy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how something happened to him. But he was born that way, a mutant, and he was abandoned, and you know, due to his ape-like looks, because he looks just like a Mandrill, except he's more humanoid, a little bit more humanoid, but. Yeah, he's like a giant red cape and boots and, blue shorts. Just the visual alone is enough to, you can't take it.
If you think about a mandrill monkey, on its own, that is already a very strange creature. Now you got a mandrill humanoid guy who's a villain, that is even stranger. So, the look of a mandrill's face has always been very, very off-putting to me. I'm not saying I hate those little animals. They're cute, but in a terribly ugly way. So this guy and his powers, Billy, that's probably the worst power you could give a mandrill like creature. You know what I'm talking about, right? His pheromones.
Yeah, he can control women.
And only women.
I mean, only his first appearance was in Shaun of the She-Devil, so it makes complete sense, I guess.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that might have been in the last issue of that series. And then, the next thing he was in, I think, The Defenders, I'm pretty sure. But,
he was.
Just an insanely bizarre character. And it just, he makes, his backstory and everything, it just makes absolutely no sense. And I know I think it's in an issue of Defenders where, I can't remember the name. He has like these minions, and they're these women in these outfits, and there was a name for them, and I can't think of it off the top of my head, but I think they like ransack Washington, D.C., and he takes over the White House and puts like a huge mandrill face on the White House lawn.
Oh, man, that's brilliant.
Like, oh, my God.
Gee, that's brilliant.
It's insane. Yeah, it's insane. I love villains like that. These are just totally crazy, don't really make a lot of sense. But
and Billy,
yeah, and that's a crazy power there.
Who do you say who created him again? The Mandrill, was it Steve Gerber or no?
I think he definitely wrote the story, so maybe he didn't create the character, but he definitely wrote those stories. I think in Shadow of the She-Devil, didn't he? I know Ross Andrew was definitely the guy who penciled them. But I'm trying to think who else could have been in on that.
Well, I mean, some of those early Shauna, issues was written by Gerber. So I could let me check on the Marvel Wiki.
Double check
Wiki
really
here.
Quick.
Oh wait, yeah. Okay, I've got it here. Let's see here. Okay, he was created by a guy or a girl, a lady, Carol Suling. Carol Suling. And wait, Steve Gerber. Okay, Carol Suling, Steve Gerber, and Ross Andrew. They co-created him. Okay, I knew, Billy, there had to be some Gerber in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Because actually, wasn't that one of Gerber's first assignments for Marvel after Roy Thomas brought him in? Because he was a friend of Roy Thomas from way back when. He was unhappy with his job at the time. I think he was a copywriter. And then Roy Thomas, he wrote to Roy Thomas at Marvel saying he's dying here in this job. He hates it. He wants to come to New York. And does Roy Thomas have a job for him? And that's how he went to New York, right? So I think this was one of the first assignments he was given, to write some of the early Shaun of the She-Devil. So it makes sense, Billy. It makes sense.
Yep. Well, it's crazy. But it's just, it's perfect for his resume.
Yeah. And you know, that just reminded me, I forgot to mention earlier who created Kalazuma. Kalazuma was created by Steve Englehart and Sal Buscema.
Oh, yeah.
Another one of our favorite weird writers from the 70s. I mean, if you think Doctor Strange, you think Steve Englehart, right? So
oh yeah, Steve Englehart, Steve Gerber, Jerry Conway, those guys, Don McGregor. I'm telling you, I don't care who writes what from now until the end of time. Those that era, they're the best.
Yeah,
they are.
I completely agree. So the Mandrill, man, why didn't I have him on my list? I mean, he's crazier than the rest of the ones that I have here. But I'll try.
I mean, you look at
yeah.
Go ahead.
No. I was just gonna say I'll try to. You know, keep up with you, Billy, because so far I think your list is way wackier than mine.
I mean, here, Mandrill. Here's what it says for his abilities. Gifted planner and strategist.
What?
Skilled acrobat and hand-to-hand combatant. Superhuman strength, speed, agility, dexterity, flexibility, reflexes, coordination, balance, and endurance. Above normal intellect. And now here's the best. Sex pheromones generation and manipulation.
Wow. I wonder what happened to Shana on those early issues. I've never read them. I hope nothing untowards happened. Some bestiality maybe on the Mandrill's part. But
I can only imagine.
Wow, we got to hunt those down, Billy. We got to find them. So brilliant inclusion. Okay, so now it's my turn, right, Billy? My number three is a villain that will only be recognizable to those of you listeners and maybe yourself, Billy, who've read Skull the Slayer, the short-lived series from the mid-70s. And this is the main villain of Skull the Slayer, a guy by the name of Slitherogue. So Slitherogue, the reason why I picked him is he's kind of a mixture between Ming the Merciless and Rama Tut and any weird, wacky sorcerer you might think of. He's got another one of those crazy, cool Sal Buscema faces. You know, Sal Buscema drew great, evil, leering bad guys. I mean, he's got this furrowed brow, but he's got, at the same time, he's furrowing his brow. He's got this evil smile on his face. And lots of wrinkles. It looks almost like as if his face is wrinkling in towards a point in the center of his nose. And he's also got this pug-like nose a la Morpheus. Gray skin. And at various points in time, he appears in different costumes. Because for those in the know, Skull the Slayer is a series featuring a type of structure called the Tower of Time, which was created by the race of scorpions. Nothing to do with the animal. this alien race called from the planet Scorpia. And Slitherogue is their leader. So what they did is they came to Earth in the prehistoric age to observe and to experiment and to discuss and to philosophize about evolution. And so what they did is they stayed on Earth and as any good scientist would do, you create models of the things you're studying. So they created this Tower of Time, with each level of the tower being a different era of human evolution or development. So, you know, if a human was to enter this Tower of Time, you would enter, let's say, the medieval level, or you would enter the dinosaur age lower down the tower. So Slitherogue was the master of this tower, and he basically like a museum curator, right, Billy? And every time he would show up in a level of the Tower of Time, he was the villain, foiling Skull the Slayer's plans to escape the Tower of Time. And he would always show up in the garb of that era. So he would show up in the Egyptian age as a pharaoh, or he would show up. But he always still had his alien appearance of this weird Ming the Merciless style look to him. And you know, he had the ability to control all of the robots in the Tower of Time. Now, the robots themselves were tragic figures because they thought they were real. You know, so in the era of Camelot, you know, Merlin the Magician, the Black Knight, who's, you know, part of the Camelot style level of the tower, they all thought they were actually real. And that was the tragic part. So when Skull eventually exposed the fact that they weren't real, it was often very tragic and heartrending. So you had Slither Oak showing up, and he could, you know, also do the standard supervillain stuff like fire energy blasts and things like that. But he was just such a wacky villain because he's one of those guys who just show up and grinned and gives a monologue, you know, and then, you know, then disappears again and says, oh, I'll see you in the next level of the tower or something like that, you know, where you're sure to meet your doom. So, you know, it's kind of like when next we meet, you'll definitely die. But it never actually happened that way. But I just had to pick him because this guy was always one of the weirdest villains for me, just because of his look and because of the fact that he clearly had the power to easily snuff Skull out, but he was playing this silly game with him, you know, probably because of boredom, 250,000 years of being bored and not having an adversary to fight. I mean, and that's the reason, I picked him as just plain weird. So
yeah, for me, Skull the Slayer, I only have like maybe 3 or 4 issues out of the, what was it, 8 issues, I think, that run. Yeah. And I did recently have a chance to buy the trade, and I was, it was literally, I think, $5. And I thought, nice. Oh, I've got to get this. And I thought, yeah, but I already have like almost half, 3 or 4, half of the issues, the single issues, and I'm still like holding on, you know, to the single issue mentality. So I didn't buy it, and I'm just like still kicking myself because I think, oh, I should have bought it.
Well, I think you might still be able to find it, Billy. It might still be out there. eBay might have it. I didn't buy that collection that you're talking about. It came out a couple of years ago, but I've got the original issues. It's actually one of, I'm not going to say my favorite short-lived series of the 70s, but definitely one that holds a place in my heart because of, you know, the time that I was collecting it. I was a kid, I was into dinosaurs, I was into time travel, I was into history, and Skull gave me those things in spades. I was even into a little bit of the Vietnam War, which is not a good thing for a kid to look into, but, you know, Jim Scully being a Vietnam War vet. And, you know, at the time, with Skull just being a normal guy, you know, when I read him, I completely glossed over the fact that he had a belt of strength, you know, a belt that gave him 10 times the strength of a normal man. So I thought, oh, this guy's just a badass because he's a Vietnam vet. So I loved Skull back then. But then when I reread the comics, you know, as an adult, I was thinking, oh, man, these things are hokey. But still, you know, the art was great, and for its time, it's a gem. So yeah, I've got fond feelings of Skull and of Slither Oak. The guy's just a crazy villain. So Billy, now we're heading towards your number 2. I'm very curious. What is your, or I know what is your second one, but I was very curious before you sent me the list. So what is your number 2?
Okay, so dipping back into the Defenders bag, I mean, we can honestly do like a top 20 or 30 of Defenders.
Oh, yeah. Villains, oh, yeah.
To be quite honest with you. And this one, though, not Steve Gerber, strangely enough, but Len Wein and Sal Buscema from the Defenders, number 13, 1974. We have Nebulon, the Celestial Man.
Oh, man. Nebulon. He's in my honorable mentions, though, Billy, but I should have, again, one of those characters I should have included in my list. What a strange villain. I mean, he looks like a BG that's been encased in gold. man, just wacky. Kind of Adam Warlock-like, but not as cool as Adam. Just
no.
disco weirdness that he exudes.
Yeah, the outfit alone. Alone is ridiculous.
Completely wacky.
Yeah, and then he's like, you know, kind of like powers are all over the place, almost like, you know, whatever you needed his powers to be to give somebody trouble, that's what they were. But yeah, great character. I mean, and then to find out much, much later after his first appearance that he's really an alien in this like octopus type form was really, really crazy.
Yeah, you see, he's like one of those characters. They're ridiculously powerful. They show up, but you can't take him seriously because of the way he looks. You know, you just want to laugh. You know, and I mean, I remember when it turned out that he was this kind of also kind of fish-like tentacled finned monstrosity. Yeah. And he's quite large, right? He's almost Shuma-Gorath size. Yeah. He, you know, it was just, what is happening here? I was just, my mind was blown, but I was also thinking, where are they going to go with this? Because this is just silly. You know, and then, but I mean, I like that era of the Defender so much that I sort of included him in, you know, just the weird kind of storylines that the Defenders were heading into and had always headed into. So I didn't mind him in his first appearance. But Billy, like everything, if you look back on it in retrospect, you think, wow, as kids, we read these things and what, we didn't think twice?
Yeah.
Now we're thinking, is it a metaphor for something? I don't know.
But I know, and I'm telling you too, it's like, it's one of those deals where Len Wein and Sal Buscema created him, but he got even crazier in the next few appearances when Gerber was writing him. So, you know, more kudos for him.
Yeah, that's right. Now, when Gerber gets his hands on a creature or on a guy like Nebulon, you just know he's going to do something interesting with it. It's almost like they're playing to Gerber's strengths by giving him these characters, or he would inevitably make them even weirder than they originally were. But, you know, Billy, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I like it when Gerber creates his own characters. You know, his own original creations are even more off the chain than the stuff they let him play with. But Nebulon is almost, it contradicts that theory, because Gerber made him incredibly weird. And it almost seemed to me like he was a Gerber creation when I first read him, you know?
That's how I feel about Man-Thing as well. You know, Gerber didn't create him, but he took like a...
Good point.
You know, a character and just... Nobody wrote that character like Gerber. Nobody came even close.
No, that's right. That's another... It's kind of like Alan Moore with Swamp Thing too. Although, no, that's different. You know, when I think Swamp Thing, I do think Bernie Wrightson and Len Wein. So no. Forget I said that, but... I mean, if you think seminal run, you'll think Alan Moore and Swamp Thing. But when you think about a character, you know, who's the first person you think about? When I think Man-Thing, immediately Gerber and Mike Ploog. You know, they jump into my head, but Gerber first. So you're right. He made that character his own, kind of like he did with Nebulon, too.
Yep, absolutely. So absolutely.
Insane. Totally insane.
So, yeah, dive into the back issue bins for... Defenders for sure for a lot of these crazy guys.
I can't remember the exact issues of the Defenders he was in, Billy, but I think I'll include that maybe at the end of the show so that the listeners can hunt down those issues. But I'm thinking it's somewhere from Defenders 30-ish onwards where he showed up.
Yeah, it was. There was a period there where for 10 or 15 issues straight, it was either Nebulon or... A group I won't mention because I know you're going to very soon.
Yes.
So we'll just let it go with that.
Awesome. Now that we get to my number two, Billy, I've just noticed that half of all the mentions on this list were Gerber creations. If you think about it. So
that's great.
Wow. I'm surprised we don't have any Jim Starlin on here because he did create some funny villains, but they never stuck around long, if you think about it. Only Thanos, you know, did, but I mean, you know, the weird villains that Gerber created, they didn't stick around long, you know. So that's why I don't have a Starlin. Sorry, I mean the weird villains that Starlin created. I don't have a Jim Starlin creation on the list. But number two, again, Billy, is a Steve Gerber creation. One of my favorite villains of the 70s. And he's someone by the name of the Fool Killer.
Oh, such a good one.
So yeah, he's a classic. He was created by, of course, Steve Gerber and Val Myrick, the artist, in Man-Thing number 3. Yeah, so he appeared early on in Manny's standalone title when he had his own solo series. And you know, he was a funny character because he was a fanatic who was obviously, I mean, as his name implies, he only killed fools. But as it turned out, Billy, it depends on your interpretation of fools, because the Fool Killer has had a lot of different people picking up the mantle of this character. Yeah. And I mean, they often, more often than not, die. They end up dying eventually. But the first Fool Killer was kind of like the Punisher, but I think he preceded the Punisher in terms of, you know, when he was created. He was a guy who was influenced by a mad preacher. A mad reverend, if you could say it like that, a faith healer by the name of Mike Pike. Pike. And then, you know, another one of Gerber's wacky names. And this evangelist, he was this young guy's mentor. Now, the Fool Killer's real name, the first Fool Killer was a guy called Ross G. Everbest, who was actually... It's a name that Gerber came up with based off of one of his old pen names, which was also something to do with Everbest. I can't remember the exact name. So then this guy, Ross Everbest, he was influenced by this this evangelist. And then the evangelist obviously preached that, you know, sinners are fools and they're going to spend an eternity in hell. You know, they get what they deserve. But then the snap in his mind happened when this young Ross Everbest found his mentor, Mike Pike, involved in an orgy, as most televangelists some inevitably end up in. Oh, I shouldn't say that, but sorry if I've offended any of the listeners.
I'm wondering to myself, was there somebody that far back? Because, you know, in the 80s, those guys were big on television over here in the United States. They were huge. They were on television all the time. So I'm wondering, was there somebody that maybe Gerber was influenced by for this story?
Yeah.
Because there was that one guy. I can't remember his name, but he was big on television all the time. He's probably still on television, and he'd been getting caught with hookers all the time.
Okay, so I don't know much about American televangelist history, but it wasn't Billy Graham, was it?
No. This is you go ahead and I'll look this up.
Okay, cool, because this is interesting. This is where it gets really interesting. So because of this, you know, schizoid, psychopathic break that happened, you know, in his mind, catching his mentor in this orgy, he killed the Reverend Mike, and then he preserved his corpse in a glass formaldehyde coffin. And then he decided, okay, fools, sinners are fools. I need to rid the world of fools. And then he dressed himself up as a kind of a buccaneer, right, Billy? A sort of Zorro lookalike. And somewhere, we don't ever find out where he obtained this technology, but he managed to get a hold of a purification gun, which was this disintegrator ray gun, which would immediately disintegrate his victims. Mm-hmm. And then he went on this crusade to rid the world of fools. And what I loved about the fool killer is before he kills his victim, 24 hours beforehand, he would send the victim his card.
And the card. Business card.
The calling card, his business card. And the victim would receive the card, and on the card would be fool killer. And then a Latin quote, e pluribus unum, which means out of the one, many. So he selected this. Mm-hmm. Out of many fools, he selected this one fool who represents all fools. And on the card, it would say, you have 24 hours to live. Use them to repent or be forever damned to the pits of hell, where goeth all fools. Today is the last day of the rest of your life. Use it wisely or die a fool. And then, you know, eventually, you know, he killed quite a few people. One of his intended victims was a guy by the name of F.A. Schist, another Gerber creation, a real estate developer, fascist.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And obviously he went after him because his projects, you know, threatened the Everglades. And then he also went after someone who criticized him, the disc jockey Richard Rory from the Man Thing comics. I love that. I love that character. Yeah.
He was good character.
Yeah, he sort of had a Roy Thomas kind of look to him, you know, with the hairstyle and the glasses. I don't know.
It was like Rick Jones.
Oh yeah,
you know, for the Hulk. That's how Richard Rory ended up becoming with the Man Thing. Like I don't want to say a sidekick, but sort of like that.
Yeah, like a kid, you know, hanger on, a fan. Yeah, it's a good point. Rick Jones for the Hulk, and then Rick Jones became that for the Avengers, and you had Snapper Carr over at DC for Justice League. Yeah, you had a lot of these characters. Yeah. Not quite sidekicks, more like mascots.
Right, Billy?
So this kid, Richard Rory, was one of the targets. But then, of course, he went after Man-Thing, you know, and, you know, then his death was pretty horrific. He was impaled on a piece of broken glass from the very glass coffin of formaldehyde that he had encased the dead body of Mike Pike in.
Mike.
Yeah. And then, he in fact ended up going to hell. I mean, later on we learn that he's actually stuck in Mephisto's hell. But, you know, so that's a bit of irony right there. He sent fools to hell, and he in fact also was the ultimate fool, thinking that he could rid the world of fools. Come on, foolishness is a part of humanity. You might as well try to destroy all of us, right?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. So in any way, that's the Fool Killer. And then later on, his mantle was taken up by a guy called Greg Salinger. But I'm not going to get into him. This first Fool Killer, Ross G. Everbest, he was my favorite. Yeah, so that's my number two, Billy. How do you feel about the Fool Killer?
Yeah, I like that character a lot. And I know I can't remember since there have been so many different versions, if it was that first version or the second version, because I think both of them had a run-in with the man thing. But one of them, it may have been the second one, because I think the second one, didn't they portray that guy as like mentally imbalanced, I think.
Yeah.
And not that the first Fool Killer wasn't a little, you know.
Yeah, he was already there, imbalanced. But you're right. The second Fool Killer, Greg Salinger, he was way more psychopathic. He was like one of those mentally disturbed people who are looking for a persona or an identity so that they could act out their fantasies of murder. So I think he literally became the fool killer because Rory, the disc jockey, he'd been in prison. I forget why, but his cellmate turned out to be Greg Salinger. And then this Richard Rory, the disc jockey, literally just told Greg Salinger about his adventures with the man thing and about this villain, the Fool Killer. And then Salinger latched onto that idea of the Fool Killer, and then he became the second iteration of the Fool Killer. And he also somehow managed to get the purification gun and the same costume, the same look. I don't know where he found that. You know what? Did Ross Everbest stash it somewhere in the swamp and Richard Rory knew the location and told it to Greg? We would never know, right? But I remember there was a cool issue of Spider-Man which featured the Fool Killer. He was a student at the same university Peter Parker was going to at the time. I forget the issue number. And then Spider-Man, he literally just, he became friends with Peter Parker, you know, this Greg Salinger. And then the whole Fool Killing rampage started when Peter, you know, something went wrong with the campus mailroom. Like a letter wasn't delivered or something. And then Peter literally said, "Oh man, you know, it's probably the mailroom that's to blame. I mean, they're the biggest bunch of fools." And then this guy, Greg Salinger, said, "Really? Oh, thanks, Peter. Thanks for letting me know." And then he went on a killing spree and started killing people in the mailroom. That's when Spider-Man had to take him out. Oh man, that was insane. Yeah. So just the concept of the Fool Killer, there's so much to do with it, right, Billy?
Yeah. I mean, I think after that second iteration, maybe it kind of really started going downhill a little bit. And I don't know why that is. I mean, maybe because Gerber didn't have his hands in the later iterations.
Well, no, actually, Gerber returned for a short-lived Fool Killer miniseries in the early 1990s. Yeah.
Okay.
But again, his hands were tied, you know, by editorial, so he couldn't do much. So he was soon off, and the series was canceled. I think it was always supposed to be just a mini, but yeah, Gerber had a third iteration of the Fool Killer. I just can't remember the guy's name now. You know, but my favorite two Fool Killers were definitely Ross Everbest and Greg Salinger. But yeah, there was a third guy. Because, you know, back in then, Billy, the Punisher was popular, you know, anti-heroes and superheroes who killed. And, you know, you had Wild Dog over at DC and guys like Lobo, and then you had the Punisher. And so, yeah, I guess the Marvel said, "Hey, let's get the Fool Killer back into play." So,
yeah.
Yeah, but I'm glad it didn't work out. I mean, I'm not glad that it didn't work out for Gerber. I mean, you know, we just had too many of those characters in the 1990s, I found. You know, gun-toting kind of main characters. Yeah, I wasn't a fan of that type of character in the 90s. But yeah, great.
No, it was good in the 70s because there was really only one for Marvel, the Punisher. That was it. So it worked because there was one. You don't need everybody like that.
Yeah, I mean, I even liked it when Frank Miller got his hands on the Punisher in the Daredevil comic, and then Mike Zeck, and, you know, you had some great Punisher runs. I just, you know, what it became was sort of a type of superhero that's a vigilante, you know, that ends up killing people. And that's not a superhero for me. You know, yeah, you can put him in a Marvel Max title. Sure, you can put him, you know, I kind of like reading some of the Punisher Marvel Max issues because I'm a fan of war, you know. I'm not a fan of war per se. I mean, war comics. I think that shows the horror of humanity. So it's kind of like reading a war comic sort of puts me off war. You know, that's the reason I read it. The same reason I read all horror is to scare me, you know, That's why I love war comics, but I don't want them to be in a superhero universe. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So it's just weird, you know, having this guy plugging supervillains all the time. So yeah, it doesn't do it to me.
For sure.
But as a villain, Billy, you have to agree, the Fool Killer is brilliant. And the Punisher, in fact, as a villain too. I like him more as a villain for guys like Daredevil and Spider-Man than I do as a hero.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, for sure.
But Billy, that brings us to the big boys. Your number one and my number one. I'm really excited to talk about these two. So you're going to start us off with your number one, Billy. Who is it?
Okay, so my number one, this guy has been probably my favorite number one for a long time. The first time I read him was in Marvel Team Up 93. He originally was in Werewolf by Night number 9, 1973, Jerry Conway and Tom Sutton. And his name is the Tatterdemalion.
Tatterdemalion. Okay, now, Billy, I've got to tell the listeners, I forgot about this guy completely until you sent me your list on Twitter yesterday. Mm-hmm. I did read him once, but I know nothing about him. I can't remember anything about him. All I know is he looks freaking strange, but his name sounds very cool. So please tell us about him. This is me coming completely fresh to this character. I want to know everything about him.
Okay, so when I first read him in the Marvel Team Up story,
yeah,
it showed an opening of like a nightclub or something like that, and Peter Parker's there, just, you know, in his normal guise. I don't know, maybe he's there for the paper, taking pictures or something. And Jack Russell was also there at this club opening. And all of a sudden, this guy comes busting in that has, like, these old, tattered and beat-up-looking clothes on. And just all the people, they start commenting on, what is that horrible smell? And it's him. So one of this guy's powers, if you want to call it that, is he smells so bad from body odor. He just makes people like want to vomit.
Oh my God. Oh no.
Yeah. It's crazy. And I guess his backstory is he used to be, like, you know, a millionaire, and I guess he was in with the mob and they ruined his business and turned on him. So then now he was, like, homeless and just completely snapped. So now he doesn't want anything to do with money. So instead of robbing all these people at this, you know, really fancy, you know, opening for this club or whatever, it's like, you know, people are in, like, you know, tuxedos and stuff. He has some kind of, like, solvent or something on his hands, and he just grabs their money and starts dissolving all their money. So he doesn't like money. Oh, he wants to get rid of all money. Jeez. Yeah, the guy's just completely lost his mind. I think when he first appeared in that Werewolf by Night issue, he was more of just, you know, a wacky villain.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of this other stuff came in later on about him, you know, and not liking money and all the thing with the mob and all that stuff. But, oh, just hilarious. Like, some of the fight scenes with Spider-Man and Werewolf by Night and him are just hilarious. Like, one of his weapons that he uses is a scarf. A scarf that has weights in it, and he swings it around and hits them with a weighted scarf.
Oh no, man! Oh man, that's crazy. That's just crazy. Oh, yeah, I love
it.
It's wild.
Wild. And he did get juiced up in some power by one of our favorite Doctor Strange villains, Satanish.
Ah, right.
He juiced his powers up a little bit at some point too, but I think that was a little bit later on, maybe post-Bronze Age, but yeah.
Right. Because, Billy, I've been racking my brains. I can't remember where I first encountered this guy. It might have been it's definitely not in Werewolf by Night, because I know he had an appearance in Werewolf by Night early on. I never had that issue as a kid. I only read that issue recently when I went through the omnibus. So it wasn't in that, but back when I was a kid I think it was in the early 80s, I did see him somewhere. It might have been Ghost Rider. I'm not sure.
Yep. He was in Ghost Rider too. Yeah, Ghost Rider. I think he was in Werewolf by Night. Then he was in that Marvel Team Up and maybe an issue or two of Ghost Rider. And I think he even may have popped up in an issue in the 80s of Dazzler.
What? Talk about an antithetical villain to Dazzler. Oh, man. Oh,
yeah, so
dude.
Wild.
Okay.
I
just want to let the listeners know, we're going to post pictures of all of the guys we discussed, all of the people we discussed. We're going to post pictures of them on the blog, sinkintotheweird.com. So you'll be able to to check out these guys and enjoy them as much as we've enjoyed talking about them, because just their pictures alone, right, Billy, is something to behold.
Oh, ridiculous. Yeah, they you don't even have to know any a backstory about some of them. Just the pictures alone, you'll get a kick out of.
So the Tatterdemalion. I like the fact that he looks like a scarecrow, homeless type guy, but he's got red and blue as his costume. You know, I like that. You know, definitely stands out. And definitely a character I want to read more about, Billy, because this guy, oh man, just his look, everything else, it's just pure gold. The quintessential Bronze Age weird character, I would say.
he's got to be up there. He's always has been, and he always will be for me.
Awesome. Well, I mean, we better get to mine, Billy. I see we're running out of time here. So this is, again, me cheating a little. Because as I did with Diamond Head, this is not one version or two different versions of a character. This is a group of characters who I included because they're all suitably weird. But standing on their own, yeah, they could be included in the list. At least one of them could. But I think they work better as a team. And they're the weirdest characters I've ever read in a superhero comic. And they are known as the Headmen. Again, you know, from the pages of Defenders, right, Billy? But in fact, three of the Headmen appeared way earlier in old Marvel titles. First, I'm going to just run through the members of the Headmen. You've got a guy, they don't really have superhero names, unless you count Ruby Thursday, who joined much later. But the three original members of the Headmen, they just used their own names, their human names. Dr. Gerald Morgan, and then Dr. Arthur Nagin. And then you had a guy who did use a stage name, which sounded suitably weird, a guy called Harvey Schlemmerman. That's difficult to pronounce. Schlemmerman. Yeah, Dr. Harvey, or Harvey Schlemmerman, who goes by the stage name of Chandu the Mystic.
Yep.
And we'll start with Dr. Jerry Morgan. He later became known as Shrunken Bones, but like I say, they never used that name in the comics. He was a genius who, much like Dr. Henry Pym or Hank Pym, could shrink things, and he ended up inadvertently shrinking his own skeleton, which caused his bones to become obviously smaller and his skin to hang on his bones like an old coat that's too big for him. Giving him the name of, you know, Shrunken Bones. And basically, he looks like this weird sack of flesh walking around. Very horrific. So, I mean, he actually originally appeared in World of Fantasy number 11 from, I think it was April 1958. And he was created by Angelo Torres, for you Mad Magazine aficionados. Angelo Torres created him in a horror story, World of Fantasy. So he's one of them. And then you've got Dr. Arthur Nagin, who's my favorite, and he's also got my favorite origin story of the bunch. Okay, he could be known as Gorilla Man, because he's a guy with a human head on a gorilla body, but he never calls himself Gorilla Man, just Dr. Arthur Nagin. He's the leader of the Headmen, and basically, why are they called the Headmen, Billy? It's because all of them suffered traumatic head injuries. Most of the cases, self-inflicted head injuries. And Dr. Arthur Nagin, his head was transplanted onto the body of a gorilla by a group of gorillas who he had experimented on. So this was kind of like, you know, their revenge. You know, he was harvesting organs from gorillas to use in people as a money-making scheme. And then the gorillas got revenge by capturing him and transplanting his head onto a gorilla's body.
The head ape's name wasn't Solovar, was it?
Ooh, a bit of a DC crossover there. If Solovar was more hardcore, I could see him doing that. It could have been more
Grodd,
of a gorilla Grodd move, but yeah, definitely. Oh man, brilliant. So, you know, he was the leader of the Headmen, and later he also joined the Lethal Legion, but that's a story for another day. So then you get to Chandu, who's also a character who appeared way earlier than he actually did in the pages of Defenders. But he's very different from his first iteration. Chandu basically was just a sideshow magician, right, Billy? And then, you know, in his first appearance, he inadvertently sent someone to limbo by teaching yoga. So then, you know, he joins the headmen, and then Dr. Arthur Nagin, Gorilla Man, transplants Chandu's brain into the body of Nighthawk, you know, from the Defenders at the time. And then Dr. Strange defeats Chandu, who had at this time point in time acquired magical powers. And then Dr. Strange put his body into the, or Chandu's brain or consciousness into the body of a deer or a fawn. Remember that crazy storyline?
And of course, that one was great.
Yeah, man, that was brilliant. And then at this point in time, you know, the headman had been joined by a female character, which is actually the only female I have on the list, the only lady. So there weren't a lot of weird ladies in the 70s, probably for the best, right, Billy?
Yeah.
A lot of weird lady villains, but this is definitely the weirdest of the bunch. Ruby Thursday, who is a lady whose head has been transplanted, or her head has been exchanged with the head of a sentient computer, which is made from plastic that can assume any form she desires. So she typically appears as this this girl with this giant red orb on her head, which is the sentient computer that she controls. And and I remember her motivation in the beginning, Billy, was she literally wanted to take over the world so that she could transplant everyone's head with a sentient computer. Man, that was great. So this head revolution that they wanted to initiate. And then she worked together with Dr. Arthur Nagin to transplant Chandu's consciousness from the deer into the body of this giant monster, this demon with like eight arms, bird wings. I don't remember what it had, a forked tongue, and it had like bird feet. And then, you know, that was the demon they were fighting at that point in time. So just a wacky assortment of crazy characters. My favorite of them being Dr. Arthur Nagin, but Ruby Thursday is a close second.
Yeah, so, for Billy, sure. They're my first honorable mention, and especially Ruby Thursday. Oh, she's great. I love that character.
Oh, man, she's amazing. No, me too. I mean, she showed up much later, too, in other comics, but I only actually read her in The Defenders. You know, when she showed up later on, I'm not sure what she did. I know she was indirectly responsible for the death of Omega the Unknown. But then she wasn't, I think, Ruby Thursday in her supervillain persona. She was just a normal woman at that point in time. I think she, because I love the series Omega the Unknown, and at the time that I was reading it as a kid, I didn't know that this was Ruby Thursday who did this, but she robbed him of winnings that he had accrued at a Vegas casino.
Casino.
Yeah. And then, you know, I think he tries to catch her, and then, you know, he's like seen by the police as assaulting this woman, just this normal looking woman. And then this is the most ignominious death of the 1970s, right, Billy? The police literally just gun him down. They just shoot Omega dead in the street.
I know. I talked to the guy that wrote that story. I interviewed him, Stephen Grant.
Really?
And he basically, because I asked him about it, because that was like late 70s, and Gerber never got to finish it the way he wanted to finish it, you know, because he was let go. And Marvel was asking people left and right to finish that story, because a lot of the fans were writing in and like saying, hey, what about this character? And, you know, it said in the last issue, the 10th issue of Omega the Unknown, that, you know, well, something's going to happen and this and that. And the way it was finished then later on in The Defenders, actually, Stephen Grant basically said in the interview I conducted with him that the only reason he did it is because, you know, he needed money. You know, he needed a paycheck and nobody else would do it. And they asked him if he would do it. He said,
right.
Yeah, how they finished it up in there, it's, you know, and of course, everybody that was a big fan of Gerber's and all was like, yeah, that's probably not how he would have done it. So that kind of didn't end so great. But yeah, great character and great 10 issues, though, in that series. It was really good.
Oh, man. I was sad about that, because for a while there, Omega was my favorite character. But, you know, the final issues of Omega sort of went off the rails, right, Billy? When they put the Hulk in there, and you know, and then you know, it was like they didn't know what to do with the character anymore once Mary screens, and Steve Gerber had left. So yeah, I guess you know, his death was inevitable. But I would have liked to see him, you know, show up again, you know, as a permanent staple of the Marvel universe. Unfortunately, that never happened. I like the character. I like the idea of Omega.
Yeah, I loved in that book how the one girl that went to school with the boy's name. I can't remember
Michael
the boy's name.
Something, Michael.
Yes, yes. There was a girl that was there. She was like, you know, maybe a year or two older. And she would call him Punk all the time. Hey, Punk. Come on, Punk. She would say to him.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I remember that. Yeah. Yep. Oh, man. That was brilliant. Yeah. Those issues were written so well, but they definitely tried to write it from a kid's perspective in the 1970s. So incorporating some slang there. But I think it succeeded for the most part. I mean, I was a kid in the 70s. Not that I was in the States, but it sounded genuine to me as I was reading it. So well done.
Yeah, Ruby Thursday, awesome character. She was in some later issues I have of Wolverine, and they were pretty good, actually. I really thought, oh, this is cool. I'll have to dig those out.
Oh, man, I never read those. But, yeah, I would have liked to follow the character, sort of like my obsession with the Orb, right, Billy? I sort of tracked down all the appearances of the Orb, and I've got most of them. I would have liked to do that with Ruby Thursday, because she is sort of the female counterpart to the Orb. I mean, just based on looks alone. But Billy, just to mention something before we stop talking about the headmen, I don't know if you remember, but one of the headmen's schemes when they were fighting the Defenders was to shrink the White House. And also Nebulon and his army of bozos at the time. The bozos, you remember
so
them?
Good. Oh, so good.
And the headmen wanted to trap them in this ant farm. So that they could study them in miniature. That was one of their schemes, one of their many failed schemes. I just love that. So not only were they weird, but also their plans were suitably insanely weird. Yeah, so that's it, Billy. That's the end of our list. I think right now we can head on over into our honorable mentions, which there is quite a few of. I'm going to just, you know, narrow mine down to five, Billy, so you can mention all of your honorable mentions in one go, in order to save time. So we'll start again with you, Billy. What are some of your...
Well, we are...
Yeah?
Go ahead.
No.
We already went and said about the headmen, for sure. They're in there. They have to be. I don't know how you can't include them in anything. They list like this. They have to be in there. And I'll only mention one other, since there was four of them, and this guy, John Kowalski from War is Hell.
Right.
You know him?
Yeah. I recently read that comic. Yeah, the War is Hell comic. You know, I've only got the one, and it was the one that I saw you talking about on Twitter a couple of months back. Or was that you, Billy? That's why
it could
I pulled
have been.
Out the
I mean,
issue. Yeah.
It was reprints of War comics until issue maybe 7 or 8 or something like that, and then it took over with new material and became a horror comic. And you had this character, John Kowalski, who had been, I think he was killed in battle, and then death, you know, in this form was there and kind of like resurrected him, made his spirit like inhabit the bodies of soldiers as they were going to be killed.
Yeah.
As penance. So, it was really cool. It was really creepy. Yeah, it's good stuff. But I mean, he made an appearance in, I think it was the second volume of Man-Thing. If I remember correctly,
that's
the
right.
There was a lot of Claremont in there,
Yeah, he did show up there. Yeah, I remember something about, I mean, I don't know which issue of War is Hell is the one I have. I think it's number 9. But that's where, that's the issue which features John Kowalski.
Yep.
It's got that great cover with Death, right, Billy?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken, Death is in the background, and you've got these two, this German soldier... using his bayonet to fight, you know, an American soldier with a knife, you know, a Bowie knife.
Yep.
And then this girl sprawling beneath his legs. Oh, man, that's a classic. I think Gil Kane did that cover, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
now.
Your favorite.
Oh, let's not bring up that again. But yeah, you're right. He did great covers, though. He did awesome covers. So yeah, I know that character well, and then I also read him subsequently in Man-Thing Volume 2, so great pick. Okay, so you've got the headman, you've got John Kowalski. Okay, I'm just going to rattle through my list here, Billy. The ones from my list that you had as your five top picks were, I think, only one, actually. I thought there was two, but I was wrong. Nebulon, the Celestial Man. I definitely have Nebulon in there. Then I've got Dr. Sun, whom we briefly talked about. Just a very serious kind of villain, if you think he appeared in Tomb of Dracula, but actually very wacky, if you look at him. Just a floating brain in a jar. Obsessed with Dracula, obsessed with immortality, but I love him. He's also of Asian. He's got an Asian heritage, you know. So, I think if I'm not mistaken, and he is arguably Dracula's greatest villain in the pages of Tomb of Dracula.
And for sure,
yeah. So I just loved him, but he's very strange if you think about it. And then second on my list is from the pages of Howard the Duck, Hal Cow.
Oh, yes.
Now, Hal Cow didn't have lots of appearances in Marvel. I think literally one issue in Howard the Duck where Howard ends up killing Hal Cow. But Hal Cow was a cow bitten by Dracula, basically, and turned into a vampire cow, right, Billy? And then, for some, you know, strange reason, started to wear a cape and cowl, just like Dracula.
I think there was an appearance in Giant Size Man Thing.
Oh, yes.
Of Hal
Cow,
a backup story. Yeah.
You're right. There was a backup. I completely forgot about that. Yeah. And Hal Cow also showed up much, much later in the pages of Deadpool. Now, I know there's lots of people aren't Deadpool fans, but I mean, lots of folks in our circles aren't Deadpool fans, Billy, but I'm a huge Deadpool fan, especially of the Joe Casey run. And I think this, if I can remember the storyline correctly, Deadpool and Hal Cow team up to fight this guy called Dr. Kilgore, he resurrected Hal Cow and then imprisoned her in order to milk her, supernatural milk, to provide him with immortality. And then Deadpool rescues Hal Cow, and Hal Cow temporarily turns him into a vampire. And then they beat Dr. Kilgore, but, you know, as soon as they're free, they walk, you know, outside the compound, and Hal Cow is reduced to dust by the sun.
Just, that's great.
Just as Deadpool fights off his vampiric transformation. Yeah, so rest in peace, Hal Cow. One of my favorite Gerber creations. And then, you know, another one is also from the pages of Howard the Duck, Billy, because I know you're not a fan of Howard, but I'm a huge fan. I've reread the series multiple times. This is a villain called the Cockroach, who's literally a normal cockroach who ends up chewing the... He ends up chewing on a magic key for some reason, scraping off the tint, the magical paint on the key, and then being transformed into this giant sentient cockroach who wears clothes. And, you know, he wants to transform all cockroaches into similar beings, kind of like the Planet of the Apes kind of thing. If you look at the new Planet of the Apes movies, you know, where Caesar wants to make all apes intelligent. You know, this is the same premise. But eventually, you know, Howard defeats him, and, you know, the cockroach takeover of the world doesn't happen. I mean, it will happen one day soon when we have a nuclear apocalypse, but, you know, not yet. Howard stopped that. So that's my one of my honorable mentions. And then the last one is a villain you know, Billy, and that's a guy by the name of Goldbug. The gold obsessed villain. he looks weird to me. He's not really a character I love, but just his look, and every time he turns up, I'm like, oh god, not this guy again. So listeners, that's it for our list of weirdest villains of the 70s. Please feel free to write in. You can send us an email at sinkintotheweird@gmail.com with your list of wackiest 70s Bronze Age villains, and then we'll discuss it on our next episode. But Billy, I think that's it for us for this week. Where can people find you online?
Definitely on Twitter. That's the easiest. I'm on there quite a lot. I'll tell you right out, I'm a social media whore. I'm on there all the time. There's no denying it. So you can find me on there. It's at @BillyD_licious.
Well, Billy, if you're a social media whore, then I'm going to be known as your social media pimp, because I'll keep retweeting the stuff you post because it's brilliant. So, yeah, I'm also on Twitter @DarkLongBox, and you can follow sink into the weird on Twitter at Into Weird. We're also there. And then listeners, we'd like some feedback, whether you send it to us on Twitter or at our Gmail address, or whether you check out the blog at sinkintotheweird.com. We'll appreciate that. And we're definitely going to be discussing your comments on the next show. But that's it for our main segment this week, Billy. we'll sign off briefly and then we'll be back right after this break. So stay tuned, listeners.
Hi, Maggie. What are you writing?
Oh, hi, John. I'm writing down ideas for a new promo for Married with Comics.
I like our old promo.
But the clips from the old promo are from an episode that's never even aired. It's lazy podcasting.
But we're incredibly lazy podcasters. And the only thing you've written down are the words, come up with ideas for the new promo.
Well, I guess we'll just have to fall back on Plan B, then.
B for blackmail professional podcast guest Tim Price into doing a Mephisto bit?
Exactly.
Greetings, internerds. It is I, Mephisto, ruler of the Netherworld and prince of all evil. I am taking this time for my evil machinations to issue a warning to everyone in podcast land. Avoid Married with Comics with John and Maggie at all costs. They're a despicably lovable pair of newlyweds who talk about comic books and other areas of geekdom with enthusiasm and joy that is anathema to me. Ugh. Just listen to them as they paraphrase panels.
For those who don't have the issue, Thor's expression is pretty much that of anyone who reads this issue once you're done with it. Yeah.
You there. Everyone's sick of this and sick of you. I am pointing where you need to go, which is away from here and away from this issue.
And I do love that first panel. It's pretty neat. I like it. Batman going swoosh.
Explain exposition.
I have no idea what's happening.
In this one, it looks like Superman's tearing a bridge down.
Why is he destroying a bridge?
I think this is part of his eventual reign of terror. And
oh, maybe.
Another thing, the bridge. Screw that.
And comment on all their favorite comics.
Everything about this issue is just gollywhackers. He's causing huge amounts of property damage, which, by the way, at least when the Fantastic Four does it, they pay the city back. Superman's not going to pay anybody back for this.
Married with Comics, available directly at marriedwcomics.libsyn.com, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter by searching for Married with Comics Podcast.
We've got everything you need.
All right, we're back for this week's show. Listeners, we won't have our regular segments airing. We went a little bit long on our main segment, which is the wackiest villains of the Bronze Age that we discussed. But, you know, we are going to preview a new segment, which is actually going to replace one of the older segments. Specifically, we're going to be replacing Get Off My Lawn. The reason being that I feel like I have to come up with something to complain about every time we do the show. And every time we get to that segment, and it makes me feel a little bit depressed. I don't always like to be negative, even though there were a lot of things when we started the show, Grant and I, to complain about. Right now, I'm just seeing, you know, the bright side of things, and I don't want to really go into, you know, all my gripes and groans. And we will, though, be talking about stuff like that sometimes, if there's anything that bothers us on the Shop Talk segment. But the segment that's going to be replacing the Get Off My Lawn part of the show will be one called The Recommendations of Ragador, which is one Billy came up with. So we're going to be recommending books, comics, movies, TV shows, stuff outside of the comics and inside. Things that we think are suitably odd and should be included in a show talking about stuff that's weird. But it'll also center heavily around comics. So we're going to be doing that come our next show. And then I want to head straight on into the Allies of Agamotto and thank everyone who's retweeted and interacted with us during our last show, which we published, well, by now a month ago. Billy and I were on vacation during August, so we couldn't record much, but now we're back, and come September, we're going to try to put out a show a week for as long as we can, barring incidents, family-related stuff, and so forth. But basically, we've got lots of time on our hands, so we're going to spend that time recording. I'd just like to give a shout-out to the following fine folks who interacted with us during our last show. Thanks to Professor Frenzy, Jerry from the Professor Frenzy Show that he runs with his buddy Chris. Jerry commented and gave us some very nice compliments on our last show, specifically of the musical kind. Jerry's quite a good musician, a guitar player of note. And he complimented our Eric Clapton segment. I've always thought Eric Clapton looks like Doctor Strange. I don't know why. Minus the glasses. And then thanks to Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast and DCOCD. He's recently become a listener of Into the Weird, or he might have been listening way back when too. I'm not quite sure, but recently he's been commenting and interacting with us. And we played his promo on the previous show, and I really love Waiting for Doom. The Doom Patrol is probably my second favorite DC team, right after the Legion of Superheroes. Sometimes they're my favorite, depending on, you know, how I feel at that point in time during my reading. But the Doom Patrol, definitely a horror-related team dealing with heavy supernatural content. So if you're a fan, check out Hicks's Waiting for Doom podcast. And then also thanks to Laurel, who you can find on the on Twitter as at Mountain Flower. Laurel, of course, is also one of the hosts of the Huntress podcast and the Birds of Prey podcast, Feathers and Foes. And she gave us some nice comments too and asked about whether we'd be again posting images on the website to go along with the topics we've discussed. And we will, in fact, be doing that again for this week's show. This is very important because I think listeners, you'll benefit from seeing the villains we discussed right in front of you as you listen to the show. So check out sinkintotheweird.com if you want to have a more interactive experience with this particular episode. And then have a look at the Fire and Water Network's recent Treasury Cast, where I think they discuss Fantastic Four Treasury Cast Volume 11, or Number 11, where Laurel is a host with Rob Kelly. And that's a great, great episode. I would highly recommend that one. And then thanks to everyone else who liked the post and retweeted the post, and all the fans out there. You know who you are. We love you guys and girls, and thanks for listening. But we'll be back with episode 12 soon enough, and I can give you all a bit of a preview. We'll be discussing something that is set in the distant past. Past that may or may not have happened, pre-cataclysmic age and a few thousand years preceding that, where we will be talking about two of the greatest fictional creations of all time, at least in my opinion. So we hope you enjoy that, listeners. Billy and I have been wanting to talk about this for a while, but until then, this is Herman saying goodbye. Stay weird, read some comics, and take care of yourselves, weird listeners. Bye-bye. Show old baby crew. I wanna tell you that everybody plays the fool. How can you help it when the music starts to play?
one cry.